Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening and welcome to Interchange. My name is Shane Young. Local election officials finally sorted the final results from the recent municipal elections just last Friday. Later on Interchange, we're going to take a look at how the state of Indiana governs elections. But first, we have an interview by WFHB News Director January Jones with Trent Deckard, the co-chair of the Indiana Election Division.
We're here with an interview with the Indiana Election Division representative, Trent Deckard, your co-director there in the office. Welcome, Trent.
Thank you for having me.
Now, just in your title, it implies the nature of your office. You're a co-director of the Indiana Election Division. Why are there co-directors of that division, and can you explain how it is accountable within the government structure?
Sure. In 1995, the Indiana General Assembly, with the signature of then-Governor Bayh, made the decision to have bipartisan election administration in the state of Indiana. By doing that, they established the Indiana Election Division with equal staffing and representation by both the Democratic and Republican parties. There are two co-directors, of one of which is me, the Democratic co-director, along with my counterpart, Brad King, who's the Republican co-director. For every decision that we make as a division, we have to literally come to an agreement on how to implement whatever we're doing, unless law by the General Assembly and the governor prescribe otherwise. We derive our authority in Indiana Code from Chapter 4.2, and we work each election cycle to try to administer elections and help with elections in a bipartisan fashion that gives both parties oversight as well as transparency for the general public on how we do what we do. We're very unique. There are, I believe, only three states quite like us. Most states typically have a secretary of state or a lieutenant governor that serve as the head of elections and then makes appointments. In Indiana, we work with the Secretary of State, who is considered to be the official head of elections, but he does have to work with both co-directors and both parties to do his duties and to help administer these elections.
So do you report to the General Assembly or the Governor's office?
We do. The General Assembly, we get our budget from the General Assembly.
Okay.
They pass it. Now, the governor does have to sign that budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so we typically, during a session, we will be at every meeting of the House Elections and Senate Elections Committees. We typically don't work directly with the governor unless there's something specific that he is interested in or that we're interested in partnering with him on. But we do advise the General Assembly as they make election law, what will work and what will not work. Because we have two co-directors, one Republican, one Democrat, we often look at things very differently, and rightly so. The General Assembly at the end of the day can still make a decision based on what they believe and what they want is their right. A good, for instance, is the photo ID law that passed mm-hmm. in Indiana. At the time of its implementation, my predecessor, the Democratic co-director, advised against it, as I would do so today. But my counterpart, who was the co-director at the time, advised for it. And so there's different perceptions on different laws on what will work in Indiana. And at the end of the day, they make a decision on our advice, and they can take that along with a nickel and move down the road if they want to.
Well, I guess the key word there is advice.
Mm-hmm.
So the election division was created as an advisory. It doesn't have teeth. It's still subject to, well, maybe a few different authorities when you keep going down the chain, but, the General Assembly, what they've ruled. But from what we've seen locally, there's also the decision-making level at the county level, at the clerk's level,
yeah,
where they get to use your advice from your office that could be opposite, let's say, and interpret it there as well.
True.
So it goes down and up, essentially.
True. There's really, with the division, we always say our interpretation of Indiana election code is, again, an interpretation. Like most legal arguments, there are several different perceptions that could be out there on how something is either implemented, what it means, what the General Assembly meant. And ultimately, after you get law, only a judge can finally make a determination, maybe in a court argument, what that law meant. So the division, we always advise folks that what we believe to be the interpretation is, as best we know, is the interpretation. There's a lot of confusion sometimes with that, but it's really because we cannot be the ultimate authority on Indiana election law. Just like a county election board has to make an interpretation, they can't be the ultimate authority. There is always going to be that interpretation, and when you get into elections and things like that, a lot of times there's many different perceptions of what the General Assembly meant in code, or confusion with that code. And so it can be a frustrating process for folks, particularly, I'm sure some of your viewers have watched over the last year as different discussion about what code meant and what it did not mean ensued. I would encourage folks to remember that it's like most things that are discussed that have a legal component to it. There are those arguments that are made, and ultimately a decision is either made, and that can always be challenged in court. But we always try to advise people as best we can.
So your office must be really exciting to work in, because it's like the practice in democracy, but in a microcosm almost, because we talk about bipartisanship and working together. You guys have to work together to give these decisions, and of course, the best decision is one assumingly made together, correct?
Correct. It really is, and I've said this. Earlier this year, the General Assembly looked at changing the way boards of voter registration work in some particular counties. Monroe County is not affected by this. And in some of those counties, there is a bipartisan administration that occurs currently, and they were looking at removing that component. I've seen how the division works, where we have to come to an agreement. And while I don't always agree with my counterpart, ultimately we do come up with a solution that brings a lot of peace to my mind, and I hope to his. So there's something to be said for that. I see other branches of government that struggle to reach agreement where necessary, and I would hope this would be a lesson, but I'm sure they have their own wisdom and advice that they can offer. The great thing about what we do, ultimately, once you get past all the legal, what some people would say mumbo jumbo and all that, when you get to what we actually do, we help people to vote. And there's nothing more great in our democracy, nothing as simply beautiful in our democracy as people going out and exercising their right. And like so many things, we get caught up in details at some point that we have to remember that your average citizen wants to be able to cast their ballot with ease, with little to no confusion, and as much clarity as they can get, and they want to be able to do it conveniently. And so I always challenge us when we get into the legal arguments — I'm not an attorney, I have a counsel that advises me for our staff — that we remember at the end of the day there is someone that is voting that's not an attorney. They need us to be thinking about what their ultimate need is at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that comes down to voter education, and how does all this changes in law, how does that trickle down to the voter, I guess? Mm-hmm. And every election cycle, you see changes in law, because the Indiana General Assembly, they'd like to tweak it every year. Mm-hmm. So that must add another interesting element to your job, where the rules change every year?
Certainly do.
Yeah.
Every session, the General Assembly goes in, and usually, this is my first session, but usually, from what I'm told, there is a change to Indiana code. As a result of that change, and changes over the years, from the 80s, we had a code that was literally about 250 pages. We now have one that is 617 pages. And there's an old saying that if you don't like something the Indiana Election Code says, keep reading and you'll find something else that will maybe make you a little happier. I think that confusion is not helpful to folks. I also think that ambiguity in language, it's not straightforward. Again, remembering we've got folks that just want to go out, they want to vote, they want their vote to be safe and secure, is not helpful. One thing I've said I will do in my term, I began in January, is work with the General Assembly to try to make our code as less confusing as possible. We have a code that is administered daily by county clerks and county officials and a million attorneys trying to interpret it, not to mention the general public who they just want to vote. And so we've got to get back to some of those basics. When we have issues where voter education needs to take place, unfortunately, it's always the bad stories that generate the most headlines. Mm-hmm. So when there is discussion about interpretation of a new code or there's a mistake that has been made potentially in code, that's what usually does more voter education. And it, again, it makes the system look like it's rough. We have to do a better job. We have to also do a better job of educating the general public about voting in general, where they can vote at, the fact that Indiana could use a boost in its registration numbers. One thing I've advised the state on, we implemented the National Voter Registration Act in the mid-90s, which require full service agencies like the Department of Workforce Development, the Family and Social Service Administration, to be offering voter registration to each person that uses those services. To my knowledge, we have very limited use right now of mm-hmm. those requirements.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
Encountered that anecdotally in either of those systems.
Yeah, and federal and state law require that. And so anyone that experiences going through those agencies or BMV, and they're not offered the ability to register to vote, they have an NVRA violation. We have to be talking about these things. And until we are registering more people, until we're getting more people involved, we can expect people to be frustrated with the process, confusion, and maybe even more apathy about voting. So I think these are important things.
Well, this election locally in Monroe County was just municipal election, so it was the city election. The only one that happened was the city of Bloomington within Monroe County. So I think it was kind of a sleeper. A lot of people didn't know there was an election going on. But I also heard that people were showing up at the polls thinking that they could vote, but they were out in the county, mm-hmm. that they didn't realize that it was only city residents. And so, I mean, that's like on the ground what happens. Mm-hmm. Someone says, oh, it's election day, I should go vote. And then they get there and realize, oh, wait, I'm not supposed to vote today. And so I think there's so many ways that the legislative bodies don't anticipate people reacting or how they're going to understand all these changes that come down. In Monroe County, I think people got very confused because there was two conversations going on at this election. One was about how this election was going to happen, and then the other one was about vote centers and next year's election. Mm-hmm. And so people here were hearing that dialogue going on in both ways. Can you tell me about your office's stance on vote centers, mm-hmm. what you guys are looking for counties to do with vote centers?
First of all, vote centers were thing added by the General Assembly as a possibility for every county to consider if they wished. We have, both my counterpart and I have advised on vote centers, and the advice that I have given consistently to counties are, when reviewing whether or not they're going to go to a vote center plan, and for your viewers, a vote center replaces your precinct day elections that you currently have, where you get up in the morning and you go to a precinct. A vote center, you can go anywhere in the county and vote. So a county can consider doing this and completely replacing the precinct-based voting. What we have advised from my end is that for a county to look at that, they need to carefully consider the locations they choose for vote centers. Will those locations be accessible to voters? We have many voters who when they get up in the morning, going to work or going to get their groceries or going for anything they need to do is a struggle. We need to think about those people. We also need to think about the turnout that we'll have in 2012. 2012 is a presidential election year. We're going to have a primary that could feature several candidates on it, not to mention the fact that we're going to be electing a governor and have a Senate election along with General Assembly and county officials. And so the turnout is going to be significant. What I would advise counties is to think about, if they go to a vote center plan, will they have enough vote centers to accommodate the many, many, many people that are going to come out? If they do have many people come out and not enough vote centers and they create lines, my concern would be that voters will literally walk out of the line. I believe every election we should be adding voters to not only our rolls but participating and casting their ballot. If we have voters that walk off, I believe that that would be a failure for our system. And so a county considering vote centers needs to make sure they have enough vote centers to match what their needs are. This needs to be a careful discussion with many aspects of the community. I applaud people that are doing that, and I applaud people that are thinking about election reform to make the system better. We have neglected to do that for quite some time, but at the same time, we have to remember we're ensuring people's ballots and we're ensuring their access to it. One of the saddest stories you can ever hear is someone saying, I wanted to go vote, but I could not for this reason or that reason. And then the next day you read in the paper, and this was a close election. Mm-hmm. That person on that day could have made a deciding vote either way that they wanted to go. And they deserve to do so. Everyone deserves to vote. Too many people fought for this freedom and what we have here. So we've got to do a better job with that. And I applaud those looking at vote centers and hope that they think about that as they go forward.
Yes, because Monroe County just, I think, has 95,000 registered mm-hmm. voters or people that could vote mm-hmm. in the primary in the spring. So think about that if you're only trying to disperse them in 20 sites. Mm-hmm. You know, and no one will go proportionally, mm-hmm. obviously. So I think you need like a Walmart or something as a phone center, empty buildings, giant empty buildings. So the county is moving towards that. They're even looking at new voting machines. Mm-hmm. And Monroe County was unique this past election. We might have been the only county in the state that used paper ballots.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so we struggled with getting them counted and getting people trained and letting everyone know what processes were going to go on. What did you hear about statewide elections? Did you hear any anecdotal things about how the elections worked out, problems, things that worked?
Mm-hmm. Elections and counties are like snowflakes. Every one of them is different. My staff laugh when I say that, but it's so true. We had election results that were in immediately. We had election results that took some time. We have some races in the state of Indiana where it looks like recount action could take place, where a vote was close, or a contest action where someone believes there was a flaw in the way voting was conducted. But overall, we know who our leadership will be for municipalities going into next year. We get very nervous before we go into every election, and it's one of those situations where we're always very happy with what happens. The election is over, the campaigns are over, and folks are taking office. We now are gearing for 2012. And it's going to be a big election year. We also will be offering training at our clerks conference for new election officials and other folks to get ready for 2012. We'll have presidential, gubernatorial, and Senate candidates out gathering petition signatures. They'll have to have 500 from all 9 congressional districts in the state of Indiana. So Hoosier voters.
Oh, to get on the ballot.
To get on the primary ballot.
Does that mean like all 10 Republican candidates will be going door to door?
They could be. So
for the presidential race.
So Hoosiers are going to see in the Republican primary potentially what they saw in 2008 in the Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. And it's whatever party you are, it is very exciting to see that sort of political activity. As a person that works in elections in this way, I'm excited because you will see a lot of activity that will and hopefully get some discussion going and engage our civic participation. And anything that increases voter turnout, that's good to me.
Well, that's an education effort in it of itself, that all this is going to be happening as far as who you're just even going to be voting for. But some other changes that came through the State House this past year included this issue about uncontested races not on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Now, we had an interview with Matt Pierce last week, and he explained where that came from. And, in fact, that law change came from someone who was a clerk themselves, and it kind of trickled up without people thinking about some of the consequences. Could you explain what that law was about uncontested races not having to be on the ballot? And then maybe we'll go into a couple of the other changes that happened that affected the election cycle this past week.
Sure. It appears that what the General Assembly may have intended to do was to give counties an ability, or I'm told the intent was to give a county the ability to make a decision at the election board level whether or not they would feature uncontested or unopposed candidates on their ballot. So if you had a candidate running for town clerk treasurer and they were unopposed, you wouldn't have to feature that necessarily on the ballot, but if you had opposed town council seats, you would feature that. That is what I'm told was the original intent. What actually happened is some coding that has created some confusion, where we have some folks that believe it says you cannot feature unopposed or uncontested candidates on the ballot, and some people
as an absolute.
Some people believe that there is wiggle room to make that decision. One thing is for certain with that. I have never seen such bipartisan backlash in commentary about that. I've heard it from party officials, I've heard it from candidates, I've heard it from clerks. Folks are very frustrated with what this provision may have or may not have done. And so I'm told the General Assembly will likely address it. I would be shocked if they did not, but again, I can't speak for them. But it did create some confusion and consternation, a lot of man hours in clerks' offices, in our office, dealing with the different interpretations that can come from this. And again, a bit of confusion.
Well, and that goes back to what you were talking about, taking the ease of voting out of the system, because, you know, maybe voting's like going to the gym. You got to go every, you know, fall to get used to it, right? And that you're exercising your right to vote. And then, you know, how are you to know, well, I'm not going to do it in 2 years because there's this municipal election, so I don't go and vote once a year.
Right.
So that is one of the mechanisms that this year really did cause a lot of what you noted, bipartisan backlash, because depending on the politics in some areas, you heard, you know, what you would have thought Republicans taking a stance on the issue that usually you'd hear from a Democrat or vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I think what it says is that it's just wasn't good for voters, regardless of the political party.
Absolutely.
And so we've heard leadership from the General Assembly that has acknowledged that as well. What were some other changes that happened this time around? That one had to, of course, overshadow much. But there were some other changes in laws, too, that might have tripped up some local elections.
Sure. Well, we certainly have the discussion about our precinct, the current precinct structure that we have in Indiana. We also have these districts, new districts that have been implemented for General Assembly seats. And now each county in the state of Indiana is going through the process of getting their new commission and council districts as well.
And so is that begins in 2012, the beginning of the calendar year?
Well,
when does that take effect?
The new General Assembly seats will be on the ballot next year. So folks in those new maps will be voting for the representation for the next General Assembly. So I would say after the election next year, those maps, those folks will be in office and representing those folks currently. Whoever's in there now would be representing you. But for counties, they are going through the process of redoing. First, they've redone their precincts. Most counties are well underway and almost completed with that, and then redoing their commission and council districts. And so that's a process by which Indiana takes the census numbers that we have that we've received from the federal census, and we make our districts right by those so that representation is approximately the same, and that it matches as best we can the demographics and communities of interest. That went through the General Assembly and passed, and now counties are going through their precincts and their council and the commission districts.
So there, though, you're talking about multiple levels of government, just mm-hmm. to be clear. So
yes.
You're talking about who represents you in the state Senate and, mm-hmm. and state House, and you're talking about council, which would be a county level.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you're talking about commission?
Commission, also with, county, yes.
Also county. Okay.
And next year we have municipal redrawing that will begin.
Oh.
Yeah. So there's always something being redrawn. But yeah, council, you know, town council, city council, all those things can be looked at in 2012 per Indiana code. And it's there's always something going on. And it's all to get numbers right by the federal census that we've got.
So from your perspective, voter education still pops out, letting people know what's going on, because what talking about redistricting, how are you going to let people know, and what other government entities, you know, have that burden to really get the word out and let people know how their district's changing?
Well, we'll rely a lot on our media friends to help us out. Typically what happens here in January, filing will begin for the most seats, General Assembly, most seats in the Senate, and all seats in the House. And so what I would expect will happen at that time as filing begins, some of these maps that have been in some news agencies will be published again so folks can see where the lines are and make decisions if they want to file for office. That will begin. But we always struggle in Indiana to keep up with letting folks know what they need to know that ultimately will lead them to the ballot box. One of the things that we do, we work in collaboration with, of course, the General Assembly, but the Secretary of State's office in getting information out to counties and to news outlets about what these current maps look like. We've the ones that are coming up for next election next year. We've had them since the early part of this spring, and as at time of their passage, there was a little bit of flurry and activity on it. But I would still expect when voters go to the ballot box next year, they will learn where those districts are and where the representation is. And I'm sure they'll have different thoughts about that, but that's ultimately what we'll deal with.
So what would solve that problem? Can you throw money at that? If your office or the Secretary of State's office got more money to either trickle down to clerks? Because it seems like since things are so specific and that at the county level, that's where the education I would think would need to come from mm-hmm. to really let people know at the county clerk level or the election board level.
Yeah. Well, and there's a limited amount of funds that we do deal with. We also have other issues that we have to educate folks on, including the requirements for photo ID, as we were talking earlier, along with other things that we do. So it's always a balancing act. We do rely heavily on the counties as filing begins to show the news outlets and hopefully the people. And they're also available, of course, on the web. But it's one of those things where, you know, we're always struggling to get information out. And to kind of go to photo ID for just a moment, mm-hmm. I saw just this morning in the Herald Times and in some conversations that I had earlier this week about a struggle here locally. Our own Charlotte Zitlow struggled for 3 hours with a young woman who was a voter, a registered voter, who did not have a photo ID. And this young lady had a 3-hour struggle to get that photo ID. I think we've got to have two things, greater education on the issue, on how you can get that photo ID, but I also would advise the General Assembly to strongly look at this requirement that was implemented and truly think if the outcomes of what we maybe intended, if these outcomes are what we intended. I I think this is something that we've got to get folks talking about. We also, in general, have to get a greater sense of civic participation. It does us no good service to, in one hand, in a social studies class in high school, tell a young person they've got to register to vote, do all those things, and then make them wait for 3 hours on election day to get an ID when they're a Hoosier and a registered voter. I have a strong suspicion we never asked George Washington for a photo ID. So this is kind of a soapbox of mine, but it's one I want folks to talk about. And I think as we get more people involved in the civic process and the voting process and campaign start, that'll get people involved. We will have a general education that will naturally occur, I believe. But it will take work, and it will take a commitment for folks talking about it.
Well, with the voter ID law, Indiana led the way on that law.
They did.
Went all the way to the Supreme Court, and now it's become a model for other states. Mm-hmm. We were doing live election coverage on election night. Charlotte Zietlow was our 7 o'clock interview. Uh-huh. So she came in fresh off that experience and told the story to us. A couple hours later, we interviewed Matt Pierce, and he gives that scenario as a hypothetical situation. He hadn't heard Charlotte's story earlier in the coverage, and Matt Pierce said, well, you know, this is the problem for people who are experiencing homelessness or don't have a permanent address. Mm-hmm. And he gave it as a scenario. Well, we had confirmed that scenario with Charlotte just a couple hours earlier. And so the reality of it is these issues, especially voter ID law, gets politicized. Mm-hmm. And maybe it can be said, oh, no, that's a myth from that political party about the implementation and the intent. But what it comes down to is that someone could barely vote that day. And if they would have given up, they had multiple points to give up, mm-hmm. But they were tenacious and had a supporter, mm-hmm. somebody helping them pursue their vote mm-hmm. for that day. And so the voter ID law, the state has also had to accommodate it. Like, we got a notice that the BMV was going to be open on election day, mm-hmm. extra hours to accommodate. So have we seen the voter ID law change the way other offices are working within the government? I mean, there's had to be accommodations, I guess, head off mm-hmm. what people see as the issues with it, right?
Well, we've had it for some time now, and we've had a lot of people do a lot of different things at the state level to try to give the assurances of the available IDs and things they need to do. At the end of the day, I would still say what I've told other state election directors who their general assemblies are considering adopting a photo ID law. I believe the photo ID law has created a headache for which we did not have a headache to begin with. I do understand some of the arguments that folks make and their concern about things like voter fraud and things like that. But I do not believe that this is the solution that we wanted. And it's another scenario I would throw out is, given the economy and given what we're currently going through nationally and here locally, we could potentially have a person who has served our nation overseas come home, find hard times, and find themselves homeless. They could be a registered voter. They could be denied in the fall for failure to get a photo ID. They could be denied the ability to go in and cast their ballot.
Because it's not just any photo ID. It's specifically a state photo ID.
Well, you need
ID.
The state photo ID. Now, if they, as a member of the military, they could have used that active. When they were active, they could have used that photo ID. That is a new change that's been made to Indiana law. But we still would have, if they were a veteran, their veteran ID card would not be able to be used as they went to cast their ballot. I just think that we have truly made a headache in a situation. And I intend to, in my term, be very frank with the General Assembly and offer them advice on what I think might help our system better. I'm not a lawyer. I am a person who has been a registered voter and voted and has been in public service for a little bit of time. And I'm sort of coming to this from an outsider's perspective. And I think we have to get back to the basics. If a person is a registered voter, they should be able to go in and cast their ballot. At the end of the day, we're all Hoosiers here. and we're all, you know, we're friends and neighbors. I don't think anyone means any ill will. They want to go cast their ballot. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, one thing we didn't talk about when we were talking about structures is we've mentioned the clerk, but, you know, not only is there a bipartisan structure in your office, there's also the county election board that makes decisions in conjunction with the clerk. Here in Monroe County, the clerk is a member of the election board, but the other two members of the election board are a Democrat and a Republican representative. So can you explain how the county election board structure works and maybe how your office works with election boards in particular?
Sure. One of the, we were talking earlier before we began about some of the myths that are in Indiana, and this is truly one of the greater myths out there. The General Assembly intended for election administration to be a bipartisan function, and that's why you have a county election board. It's similar to the election division, though in Indiana you have a clerk that carries out the day-to-day duties and diligently works to administer elections. But you do have a county election board that has bipartisan oversight over a county election. They do have a responsibility to do their functions and duties together. It was intended to give both parties representation along with the clerk in conducting the election. So what we do is we always encourage them to get together, as we have to do, work towards whatever they need to do to follow Indiana code and to administer their elections. Ultimately, county election boards get pretty crafty in dealing with the headaches that they have. And I will tell you, they have about 150,000 more headaches than I do on a given day.
And they're also volunteers?
Oh, yeah, for the most part, they're volunteers. The clerk is paid. We probably don't pay our clerks near enough for what they deal with, but they do. They're volunteering their time, and they're administering the election with good intentions. What we do is we offer to the county election boards a chance for election training along with our clerks at our December conference that we do. We've got one coming up, and we certainly invite them to attend because at the end of the day, when the election is done, they sign off on that election, just like the clerk and anyone else. And so that's the function that they do.
Well, we experience quite a bit of deadlock because of that structure, and also because the Indiana Election Division has a bipartisan structure. So we've been discussing kind of some of the benefits of that system in compromise and agreement, but we would have somebody, the Republican member of the local election board, agreeing with the Republican member of the state election division. But the Democratic member of the local election board had a differing opinion from your side of the aisle on interpreting specifically the uncontested ballot races. So in that situation, the clerk's the decider. Essentially, when we get stuck like that. But the clerk is also a member of a political party. So is it fair to say that any county really is administered by the political party that the clerk's office is for the election?
Well, at the end of the day, the one thing you always have to remember, and this is why I would always advocate for having an elected official involved in most major decisions. I know there's always an argument about privatizing and all that, and I won't get into it. But when you have an elected official on the line and involved with the process, that is a person that is extremely answerable to the public. It also has to be remembered that both of the county election board members are appointed by either party and represent either party in the election process. Both of those parties have candidates on the ballot. And so conventional wisdom that I've always heard fellow candidates say anytime there was a political issue that was affecting one party or the other, I've always heard them say, we have to be very cognizant of how we're governing, how we're appearing in those things. And so ultimately, we're all operating in a very public sphere. If I do a horrible duty by my job and the General Assembly sees that, they may not approve of the structure of my office. They also may choose not to fund my office. It's always a risk that we take. So ultimately, we all are answerable to the public, and that pressure has a tremendous way of making things work. I know election boards in the past in all counties have had moments where they're a little more strident. But it's ironic that sometimes the next cycle around, things can kind of come together. And I think that's good. If it cannot, they truly have to evaluate what they're doing and if they can do it together, and maybe if there's other people that are more appropriate.
Well, moving forward to next year, spring will come right around the corner faster than we know. Mm-hmm. What do voters need to know? What are they facing next year? If this was kind of a sleeper election, we had very low voter turnout for the municipal elections. What do people need to have their heads up for coming in the spring when they're ready to participate again in the primaries?
Well, if this year was a sleeper election and next year is viewed as a sleeper election, then we will never have an awake election. 2012, truly, there is a lot going on. Again, we'll be electing a president for the next 4 years, and these times we'll be electing an Indiana U.S. Senator, and we'll be electing our governor. We'll also be electing new members to new maps of the Indiana General Assembly, along with our county officials. In some communities, not here in Monroe, they will have some limited municipal elections. Some towns will be on the ballot. And so we'll have a lot of people up at stake, the leadership for country, state, and counties, maybe for the next 4 years. We're going to have candidates getting petition signatures. All three of the major candidates, gubernatorial, presidential, and Senate, are going to have to get 500 signatures per each congressional district of firm registered voters. Counties will have to process that. People are going to see a tremendous amount of voter activity. They're also going to be pushed to register to vote. I would push them now to register to vote. They could do it right today at indianavoters.com. Rather than the traditional form we've always used, you can use that, but go to indianavoters.com, register to vote. They can apply to vote absentee as the election approaches. So lots of different things are going to be going on. There's going to be campaigns saying lots of things, and a lot of voter drives and other efforts. Our friends in the League of Women Voters and all those folks will be out doing their voter education. We appreciate that so much. But I don't know how the folks will miss this election unless they choose to. There will be a lot at stake, a lot for them to decide. What we as election administrators have to do is to make sure that as we enter into that, some people say silly season, some people say fun season, I think it's both. As we enter into that, we have to make sure that we are telling everyone about the necessary timelines that they have. Candidates have a window by which they have to file. And keeping them posted on that and doing our best to answer questions to voters.
How will people find out about the redistricting process? Because Monroe County in particular was recut for the Senate and the Indiana Senate and the Indiana House. When will people be able to get that information and find out who their new representative is?
Mm-hmm. Well, they could actually find that information now. It is available online. They could contact the Indiana Election Division and we could direct them to appropriate resources for that. But ultimately, as candidate filing period begins, or we get close to that, I believe that there will be a lot of publication of these maps so folks can see them, take a close look at them and see where they live. I sympathize wholeheartedly with folks that know about those lines. I literally have a backyard fence that is a Indiana House line. I'm so proud to own that. But yes, it can be confusing, and voters at the end of the day, they just want to know and they want to go out and vote.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Trent Deckard from the Indiana Election Office, co-director up there.
Glad to do so. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Interchange on WFHB. Support for WFHB comes from Bikesmith's Bicycle Shop. Established in 1975, Bikesmith sells Cannondale and Giant bicycles, services all makes, and provides accessories. Open every day, a half block south of the courthouse and a half block east of the Beeline Trail at 112 South College is where you'll find Bikesmith's. And support for WFHB comes from X Printwear and Promotions, specializing in corporate apparel, athletic wear, promotional products, business cards, and letterhead. X Printwear is located on Bloomington's west side. More information is available online at xprintwear.com. And wrapping up tonight's Interchange, Host Nancy Woolery speaks with Sheila Evans and Jackie Bauer in a new project to educate citizens about environmentally healthy homes.
This is Nancy Woolery for WFHB's Interchange. And today we're going to be talking about a Healthy Homes Initiative, and I have two guests with me today. One is Jackie Bauer from the City of Bloomington, and Jackie is the Sustainability Coordinator, and Sheila Evans from IU Health, Community Health Education, and Program Manager. And my first question is, what is the Healthy Homes Initiative?
Well, the Healthy Homes Initiative is consistent with CDC and state initiatives, and basically it's a holistic approach to preventing disease and illness that result from housing-related conditions. And the focus is to identify the problems in the environment and eliminate them or mitigate them.
With winter approaching, what can people do to stay healthy?
Well, one of the things that we think of a lot in winter is that when we make our homes more energy efficient and we tighten them up, we need to be really aware of what we're bringing into the home that could be toxic or an irritant to people's health.
Yeah, and that's right. What Sheila said is correct. But, you know, energy efficiency has all kinds of benefits, including monetary savings. Most homes are, it's unlikely they're going to get so tight that energy efficiency is going to cause problems. But if you've got an air quality issue in your home, it's at least good to be aware so that you can mitigate any problems you might have. Radon is one issue that I know is a concern. If you've got a radon issue, it's good to just ask that question before you really start focusing on energy efficiency. But that said, energy efficiency in general reduces the amount of coal we burn, which has it reduces the amount of pollutants in the air due to coal burning. So it's overall a much better thing for the environment as a whole and for people's health as a whole.
Well, speaking of radon, I didn't even think about getting a radon check. You know, I have a basement in an older home. Until I went to sell my home, and in order for the buyer to get a loan, they had him do a radon test, and it turned out that the radon was high, and I had to have what they call a radon mitigation. So I don't think a lot of people really realize that we have one of the highest radon levels in the state of Indiana.
Yes, and the only way that you would really know that is to have it tested, like you said, because it's odorless and tasteless, and mm-hmm. You know, the only way you would know if you had a radon issue is to have it tested. You can actually purchase home testers from hardware stores and follow the directions carefully, and if you have an elevated level, then you might want to check with the Monroe County Health Department or your county health department to see what resources are available to help you.
Okay, thanks, Sheila. I'd like to talk about how indoor air quality makes people more susceptible to health issues, such as candles, air fresheners, mold, tobacco, we already talked about radon, and green cleaning.
Great. I think that's a real concern because there are some health issues that are related to poor indoor air quality, like asthma, and it certainly increases the risk of SIDS for little ones. It can reduce lung function for older children as well as adults, and it increases the chance of respiratory illnesses and infections if you have a constant irritant to the respiratory system. So one of the things to also think about is that children are more vulnerable to different types of illnesses due to the fact that their bodies are still growing and they're smaller, so just a little bit of toxin can make it more concentrated for a small individual. But also some of their behaviors, like crawling on the floor or putting their hands in their mouth. If there are irritants or toxins in the environment and they settle to the ground, then children are going to get exposed to them more so than adults.
And this is where the same pollutants that cause health issues often are the pollutants that you don't want in the general environment overall. So to the extent we can reduce the amount of toxic cleaning chemicals we use and that we can avoid using other things that bring pollutants into the house, we're actually not introducing those into the environment generally. We may be avoiding manufacturing processes that emit pollutants that we'd be concerned about. So there's a lot of nice synergy between a healthy home and a healthy overall environment that we really want to preserve for the overall population.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jackie.
One of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit about is something that we think a lot about over the holidays, and that's like things like candles. And candles can be a good thing or a bad thing. And if they're paraffin-based, remember that's a petroleum product, so what we usually recommend for candles is soy-based or beeswax. And then there's little things that you can do if you really like candles. And one is that you need to make sure that you're using candles that have natural scents to them, like using essential oils instead of artificial scents, and keeping the wick cut down to about a quarter of an inch, so that it doesn't, the longer the wick, the more soot that's produced. And also looking at the wick, if the wick has a little bit of a metal base in the inside, it's possible that could actually be lead, which is, we know, is really bad to burn lead. And also keeping candles in a draft-free area, because what you really want to do is reduce the amount of air that comes around the candle so that it doesn't cause more soot. So little things like that we can do that really kind of prepare your home for the holidays, but don't expose your children or yourself to irritants or toxins in the environment.
Okay, thanks, Sheila. Besides indoor energy efficiency and indoor air quality, are there other things a person can do to stay healthy in the winter?
Yes, there are. I mean, certainly it would be good to just have a good, wholesome diet of whole foods and a variety of foods. And also, one of the things that you might think about is offering as many organic foods as possible. So, because you really don't want to expose yourself to a lot of pesticides, and fruits and vegetables can have pesticides on them, there's a list that they call the Dirty Dozen that the Environmental Working Group puts out that talks about the fruits and vegetables that have the most pesticides on them, and those are things that you would want to avoid if possible, or buy organic. And then there's also something called the Clean 15, and those are fruits and vegetables that have the least amount of toxins on them or pesticides on them. So if you bought those without them being organic, then that would still be probably okay. So if you're interested in that, you can go to the EWG.org website and check out what the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15 are. But so healthy foods, good exercise, which sometimes gets a little bit more challenging to do in the wintertime, and then reducing the amount of toxins in the environment. Can you think of other things, Jackie or Nancy?
One thing that I think people don't often consider when they're talking about healthy homes is where the home is located. And if your home is located in a place where you can walk to the grocery store or to the bus stop or wherever you might need to go to school, you're going to get a lot of incidental exercise as a result of where you are. And that's regardless if you're determined to do it, regardless of what season it is. And they've shown that even incidental exercise has tremendous long-term health impacts. So in addition to looking inside your home, it's good to look at the environment around your home and where your home is, since that can have such great impact on health of children, especially if they develop that habit of walking early on in life. Mm-hmm. They're going to be much better prepared and much healthier for their adulthood.
The other thing that I wanted to briefly talk about is the issue of cleanliness and disease and illness, and that is that sometimes, you know, we tend to think if we keep all the germs out of an environment by using antibacterials or anti microbials, then that's a good thing. But that's not necessarily a good thing. And just sometimes cleaning with just good old soap and water is probably the best thing that you can do. Using natural cleaning products like vinegar and baking soda and lemon juice, those are all things that do not contribute to poor indoor air quality like toxins do. So it's a good idea to just clean as naturally as you can, and to eliminate the use of toxins. Even bleach can be very irritating to someone's respiratory system if they have problems or reduced lung function. So good old soap and water is probably one of the best things that you can do. Like Jackie said, getting some exercise, going outdoors doesn't make you sick. It's, there has to be pathogens that are present, but using antimicrobial and antibacterial lotions and creams and soaps really don't make any difference. It's just soap and water and good old-fashioned, natural cleaning products that are really what people are recommending now to improve your health to keep you healthy.
Well, and a good example of a green cleaning substance that's just something you'd have around the house. So you can use vinegar and water, a real dilute solution of vinegar and water to clean windows. And if you compare that to a commercial window cleaner and look at the ingredients on the label on a commercial window cleaner, it's kind of astounding. And there's a lot of stuff you won't even be able to identify. And probably if you look it up, it's likely something that you wouldn't want to be exposed to. But you could actually drink your vinegar and water window cleaner. I'm not saying you'd like the taste, but it's a safe, it's very, very safe, and it does a great job. So, there's a lot of these things where you're not talking about compromising the quality, but you are looking for ways to reduce the toxins that just aren't necessary.
And if you're one of those people that really likes that scent, it's best to avoid the artificial scents, but there's certainly nothing wrong with if you like the smell of a scent, a fragrance of some kind. You can buy essential oils and you can make your own air freshener. And you could just put 15 to 20 drops of essential oil in 4 ounces of water and put it in a mister type spray. And you can spray that into the air, and you can buy whatever scent that you like and use that instead. You want to just make sure you shake it good because of the oil and water that you're mixing together. Shake it good before each use. But or you could even just take essential oils and drop a couple drops on a cotton ball or a tissue and let it kind of just evaporate and air out. You can cook something good and wholesome for your family that makes your house smell good. But a lot of people get used to these air fresheners that you buy in the store, and they're just really not very good for your health. They're especially irritating to the respiratory system. So probably best to avoid those, but to go with more natural cleaning, like the ideas that Jackie recommended, or essential oils, or some fresh flowers, or a cinnamon stick, and a little pot of boiling water. Something that's more natural is better for your health.
Great. Thanks, Sheila. These are wonderful suggestions and some really good information that both of you brought to the program today. So wrapping up, I just wondered if there was anything else that Jackie or Sheila would like to mention before we end our program.
Well, one thing that I feel like I need to mention is the issue of tobacco and smoke. And that is that, of course, we know that it's not healthy to inhale secondhand smoke, so you should smoke outside. But now we're actually recommending that you put some kind of protective coat or something on to protect your clothing, because we now know that there's something called third-hand smoke, which is what settles on clothing and furniture and in the environment, that can also be irritating, especially to young children. So good idea not to allow people to smoke, but to in your home or your car, but to also think of protecting the clothing and the furniture around you so that it doesn't collect the residue from the tobacco smoke.
Well, and if I could just say, I think people often think of the issue of sustainability as separate from health, and people maybe tend to forget the social aspects of sustainability. So there's a very deep connection between health and sustainability in that we want, as a part of sustainability, we want our population to be healthy, we want them to be educated, we want them to be capable of taking care of themselves and their families and being contributing members of society into the future. But then there are also there's great synergy between sustainability and health in terms of, say, cycling and walking, where if we start to think about building a community that satisfies environmental goals in terms of reducing the number of car trips people feel are necessary to make, that also has a health impact on those people. The more people are walking, the more people are biking, the healthier they are, and it meets that environmental goal as well. So there's a lot of connections between sustainability goals and health goals, and I think it's really important to remember that. And that goes down to that micro level of the house too, where we really want people to be healthy. We want them to have a good atmosphere for studying or for relaxing after work or for doing whatever they need to do to succeed in their lives. And we also, that just ties into all these nice community goals. So it just works together really, really well.
I totally agree.
Well, we're going to wrap this up, and I thank Jackie Bauer and Sheila Evans for coming in today. If people want to get more information about sustainability or the Healthy Homes Initiative, who should they contact?
Well, if they're interested in more information about the Healthy Homes Initiative, they can contact me, Sheila Evans, and my phone number at work is 353-5767.
And to get a hold of me at the city with questions about sustainability, you can either visit the city website. We've got a lot of great sustainability pages. Look for the Sustainable City Initiative. And if you want to get in touch with me directly, my email is sustain@bloomington.in.gov.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nancy.
This is Nancy Woolery for WFHB's Interchange.
Thanks for tuning in tonight. I'm your assistant producer and engineer, Shane Young. Interchange is produced by January Jones. The original theme music is by Jamil Effiam. Stay tuned for Stardust, coming up next here on WFHB. Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of community radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.